This is the Takeaway Podcast for Wednesday, August 26th, 2015. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It's our last day broadcasting from the studios of Colorado Public Radio here in Denver, where this week in the shadow of Pikes Peak, Colorado is showcasing a vision of innovation that is more about reaching for a summit than the traditional Silicon Valley. But first, a dark vision of innovation that delivered a reminder this week that it is alive and well in the Middle East in the form of images of ancient ruins and cultural artifacts in the Syrian city of Palmyra turned to rubble this summer to glorify the self-described Islamic State, or ISIS. ISIS talks a lot about erasing all of history before the golden age of Islam 14 centuries ago and stopping all the time that has passed since by proclaiming their caliphate. This religious element is most often how ISIS is described by U.S. policymakers. But could this time warp be largely fanciful rather than about the faithful? Is the ISIS Islam, minus all the violence, like a contemporary megachurch you might see in the American Midwest, great for raising money, but a little fuzzy on authenticity? Broadly speaking, is ISIS actually just a modern police state, gilded with Qurans, but more mafia than Mecca? Joining us is Jason Burke, a reporter for The Guardian and the author of the forthcoming book, The New Threat from Islamic Militancy. Jason, how modern is ISIS, and how much of a fiction is all of this evocation of the Middle Ages?
I think it's very reassuring to talk about the Middle Ages, talk about ISIS as medieval. It makes them sound very distant. It makes it sound like the whole phenomenon of ISIS and indeed Islamic militancy more generally has just come out of a previous age, and we can somehow push it back into a previous age and carry on living our lives. And sadly, I don't think that's the case. ISIS are deeply contemporary, both in the way they've been created, in the way they act, and in the way they think. If you look at the videos, the terrible videos, the shocking, atrocious executions that we've seen. Now, those images are clearly evocative of a previous age, if you like. They look medieval, but think about it a bit more deeply, and you can see that they're made using state-of-the-art technical digital equipment. They can only be broadcast because of digital technology. Otherwise, we would not see them. When 10 years ago, other militants started using the same kind of techniques, the same kind of tactics to terrorize, they weren't able to reach anywhere near the same kind of audience. They weren't able to shock in the same way. Now, that's a contemporary phenomenon. The same would go for funding of many Islamic militancy groups. The groups were crowdsourced in a way in terms of their financing long before the term was invented. The whole concept of leaderless jihad that you'll hear a fair amount, that's a very contemporary concept too. It's about empowering individuals to act autonomously while referring to a central body of ideas. All of this is modern, and it's about the developments that we've created in our societies or other people have created in their communities over recent decades or years being used for very, very negative purposes.
And is there a contemporary piece to what we've reported on this program, how women are traded as sex slaves in these markets that there's actually been video smuggled out of Syria and Iraq showing that these women are kidnapped and then offered up to sexually repressed traditional Islamic men as a recruiting tool? And even though the evocation is that of sex slaves somehow are consistent with the Quran, in fact, the way they operate is much more like some sort of a bizarre terrorist hookup site using the internet to attract men, using these women as bait. And that has nothing to do with Islam, but everything to do with modern sort of pornography media.
Very much so. There's that element that is sort of highly pornographic. There's also the element that all over the Middle East and other regions in the Islamic world, young adult men are finding it very, very difficult to attract young adult women. And those young adult women are being increasingly independent, making their own choices about who they want to marry or have relations with. There are economic issues, such as how difficult it is to raise the money to marry in much of the Middle East. And these are kind of very real modern problems that are confronting the kind of young men who get drawn to radicalism. And this is providing one kind of deeply twisted immoral and repugnant solution. Now, as you point out, just because it's referring to texts that are 1400 years old doesn't mean it's not a contemporary phenomenon. It's ISIS, in much of what they do, is much closer to a rogue state, criminal mafia organization than it is to anything that is religious in any sense. Clearly, there is a profoundly important religious component, and it would be ridiculous to deny that. But in its nature, in the way it rules, in the way it terrorizes, much is reminiscent of, for example, Saddam Hussein's Iraq before 2003.
It's even a throwback to, you know, Stalinism, in the sense that, you know, Stalin ruled with an ideology that was a fiction, a very convenient fiction, but mostly it was terror and the police state that kept everything in order. And the borders were fudged in Stalinist, you know, Eastern Europe and Russia. And just like in Syria and Iraq, as you write, this is a platform for a kind of expansion in the Middle East. But the ideology, Islam in this case, is just a sort of convenient flag that they wave.
Well, I think you can underestimate the Islamic component. I mean, in that they genuinely believe this. I mean, there's that's why I think it is right to call it Islamic militancy. But then all faiths, all great faiths, have resources within them that can be instrumentalized, can be used, can be deployed for a whole range of different purposes. And ISIS have their purpose, which is to gain power, to change the environment, to change the way people live, to re-establish what they see as the lost glory of the Islamic empires, not necessarily of the 7th century, but very much from the 8th, 9th, 10th, and through to the 15th, 16th century, where in the Middle East, the great Islamic empires, such as those of the Abbasids or the Ottomans or various other dynasties, were extremely powerful. So there's that kind of nostalgic element involved as well. But I mean, one thing that's very striking, I've reported a lot in the Middle East in the 90s, last decade or so, and you know, you look at many of the elements that characterize the Islamic State, and they are very familiar. You're talking about an aggressive anti-Semitism, use of violence to terrorize entire populations, sectarian dynamics, inefficient administrations, corruption, all of these things. None of that is unfamiliar in the region. And in many ways, ISIS is a product of its region. Yeah, a revolutionary product in a sense. But you know, you were talking about Stalinism and those left-wing ideologies. Variants of those Stalinist ideologies, that kind of hard left centralized authority idea, were very much prevalent in that region until relatively recently. So you've got to see ISIS as a product of its circumstances rather than something that's just erupted from 700 years ago or whatever.
Does that give it staying power in military terms? We've had a report this week that the Pentagon is actually investigating allegations that military officials have you know, made very optimistic intelligence assessments about the campaign against ISIS that suggests that we're making much more progress than we actually are. And I'm wondering if the staying power of ISIS is actually solidifying rather than growing weaker.
I think it's very difficult to say. One thing that's very clear about ISIS is it hasn't suffered any really significant reverses yet. There have been some minimal reverses, some quite symbolic reverses, such as the fighting around Kobani, the northern border town, earlier this year, at the end of last year, in which US airstrikes were very important. But overall, it hasn't really suffered a bad defeat yet. So we don't know how fragile it is ideologically or in terms of its credibility more generally. What I think is certain is that it will stay and it will thrive to a certain extent as long as there is chaos in Syria and a major governance problem in Iraq. And those are the two factors that have led to ISIS emerging and being able to seize the territory that it's seized. It is strong. It has a coherent mission statement, if you like, which is sadly, tragically attractive to a certain number of people. But that can be reversed quite rapidly when ISIS has very little left to offer. And you have to imagine quite how bad it must be for anyone to be attracted to ISIS as the next best alternative.
Look to Damascus, which is a throwback to another kind of history. Jason Burke, thanks so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Jason Burke is a reporter for The Guardian and author of the forthcoming book, The New Threat from Islamic Militancy.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Innovation is great until it gets expensive, right? Colorado is a center of innovation in the energy sector with startups and tech companies working on new ideas above the ground and below the ground. And some of those companies are very familiar names.
How do we make, simply put, better wells?
And that is simply put. That's Halliburton's president of Western Hemisphere Operations. Recognize that name, Halliburton? Jim Brown is his name. He's speaking at an energy conference in Colorado earlier this year. In a world of $100 a barrel oil, there's one set of incentives to make better wells. But with oil trading in the 40s, and with some predictions of it trading as low as $20 a barrel by the end of the year, what does that mean, a better well? Reporter Lee Patterson and data journalist Jordan Werfs-Brock are with Inside Energy. How does innovation in extraction and capture of oil and gas survive in this environment, Lee?
Well, it's a particular type of innovation. We're not talking about groundbreaking technologies that have never been used before. These days, the way we're getting more out of each well is by drilling wells faster. Some companies are drilling wells in half the time that it used to take before oil prices dropped. They're also focusing on their most productive wells. They're looking at the sweet spots, and the sweet spots are the areas that are richest in hydrocarbons. A lot of producers have also started using downhole sensors, which with recent technological innovations can now withstand very, very high heat. And those sensors can provide data to the people up above ground about, you know, what's going on. Halliburton in particular has started using something called a diverting agent, which is a biodegradable chemical that you shoot down into the well, and it sort of seals off some of the fractures so that engineers can better direct the frack to the rocks that are richer in oil and gas.
It's fluid mechanics being applied more efficiently to really push that oil out without losing it in the deep underground shale.
Exactly. And diverting agents are actually a key component of something that's also becoming pretty popular these days, and it's called a refrac. And a refrac is exactly what it sounds like. You shoot chemicals and sand and water down into a well that you've already fracked to get more oil and gas out of the ground. The reason for doing that is because it's cheaper than drilling a new well. So a diverting agent can be really key in that process.
What is the break-even point for these fracked wells? And you know, because fracking itself is an innovation that really transformed the entire industry over the last 10, 15 years. Do these wells work at $20 a barrel, at $40 a barrel, at $50 a barrel, at $100 a barrel?
That all depends where you are. And the break-even point can vary even within one play. It all depends on where the richest hydrocarbons are. And a lot of other very complicated factors. And that break-even point is really what this is all about.
Some of the data stuff is really scary, Jordan, here, because I've read that you don't get much out of these wells. It's the percentages are like 7, 12% what it comes out of some of these wells.
Right, and the interesting thing is most of that production comes in the first portion of the well's life. So it's going to be operating for 30 years often, but you get a big bump at the beginning, and then the production kind of sloughs off over time. So it's really hard to look at the long-term payback on a well when you have to take that into consideration, too.
And so in many ways, it's because the pressure goes down or the easy stuff goes away, and part of the whole diverting agent is a way of getting more pressure down there to wash the rest of it out.
Well, I think, you know, I think the fact that so much oil and gas is left in the ground, you know, there are a lot of different reasons. It's really hard to know what's happening underground. You know, extraction is a complicated process. And if oil is drawn from a field too quickly or from a bad location or from the wrong kind of well, large amounts can be left behind. And, you know, I've even read estimates that if we deployed all of the current technology on the market in any, you know, any particular reservoir, we would still only be able to get one third of the oil and gas out from under the ground. And I think that's just, you know, due to technological limitations.
With gas prices the way they are now, is there any incentive for producers to capture all the gas that usually flares out or that often just leaks through pipelines and various other sorts of processing infrastructure?
Ideally, but the complication with that is when gas is flared, it's often because at that particular drill site, there's no infrastructure to transport it. And so it does sound like a cost-saving mechanism, but they would have to build pipelines and compressor stations and all that to be able to monetize that natural gas. So it's complicated.
Now, environmentalists, of course, listening to this conversation would say, well, then, of course, the innovation is conservation. That's the real innovation, and that's what we really should be investing in. And if these things don't work at $40 a barrel or $30 a barrel, it's up to the consumers and for energy companies to really innovate on the conservation side of things. Where does that stand?
Well, so we've talked to several companies, many of which are in Colorado, some are in Texas, that are really focused on environmental innovation in the energy sector. And there are companies that are gathering gas that would otherwise just get burned off, which is what we were talking about before. There are some companies experimenting with capturing diesel exhaust and turning that into electricity, but they might have a stronger future later on when oil prices go back up. I mean, I've talked to many of these companies. Business is okay, but it's not booming. The Halliburtons of the world are not calling these guys to say, hey, we want to use your new thermoelectric heat generator to, you know, capture diesel and turn it into electricity. That's just not the kind of investment that the big dogs are making right now.
Does the goalpost move in this volatile environment of oil price fluctuations? In other words, does the data picture of energy production and energy innovation fundamentally change when you shift from a $60 barrel world to a $30 barrel world?
Well, the interesting thing about natural gas is, unlike something like coal, it can be used for all kinds of things. So not just generating electricity. It can be used in manufacturing. It can be used to make fertilizer. So it actually can be diverted into other sorts of ways to make money. So if you're a natural gas or an oil company, you've actually got some options when the price does drop.
Jordan Wirfs-Brock and Lee Patterson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Lee Patterson is a reporter and Jordan Wirfs-Brock is a data journalist with Inside Energy, a public media collaboration funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, focusing on America's energy issues. And one more thing before we go. While the rig count has dropped just over 53% since this time last year, crude oil production, due to innovation, is still higher than what it was a year ago.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Last week, the Koreas were shooting at each other. This week, they are signing historic agreements to silence their guns.
The two sides did get together. They did come to an agreement that they both found mutually satisfactory. And that's the important thing. And that tensions now, which had been running pretty high over the last several days, have an opportunity to decrease a little bit.
That State Department spokesman John Kirby not exactly talking as though he has much quality intelligence on what's really going on. Sun-Yun Lee is a professor in Korean studies and an assistant professor at Tufts University's Fletcher School. He believes that what we are seeing here is more water ballet by North Korea than any watershed diplomacy. As evidence, he cites the curious way in which this crisis suddenly blew up and then just as suddenly evaporated.
Earlier in the month, on August 4th, two South Korean patrolmen soldiers were severely maimed, losing their legs, when two North Korean landmines blew up along the patrol trail in the South Korean zone. So these were determined to be North Korean planted mines. And as a rebuttal, I suppose, South Korea started for the first time in over 10 years anti-North Korean regime propaganda music, critical things about the regime started to blare out of these loudspeakers along the border. So North Korea threatened to shoot down the loudspeakers and came out with an ultimatum even, saying, turn them off by 5 p.m. on August 22nd or else. And at the 11th hour, dramatically, North Korea said, hey, let's meet and let's talk it out. And over the past 3 days or so, the two sides met, had extensive extended discussions lasting over 43 hours, and North Korea issued a non-apology, really a devious, sorry, apology, speaking as if North Korea were a third-party observer in having planted the mines, and in return got South Koreans to turn off the loudspeaker. So this is a small victory for North Korea. But more importantly, I would say South Korea will be eager, will be more inclined to re-engage North Korea, even with the next North Korean provocation.
Aside from the tragedy of the maiming of the South Korean soldiers, this all sounds very superficial and almost infantile, the ways in which these two countries engage with loudspeakers, etc., and these threats. But yet you believe that in this kind of ritual, there is a realistic symbol of how North Korea is trying to ratchet up tensions with South Korea.
We have this image outside North Korea of North Korea as poor, backward, and bizarre, and certainly the regime fits all of those characterizations, I would say. So we tend to patronize North Korea, underestimate North Korea, but when it comes to propaganda, when it comes to strategic deception, they are very, very good. And over the past 25 years, North Korea, for repeated lies of denuclearization, has reaped tens of billions of dollars of concessions from the world's biggest countries. So I see this as another game played by North Korea, elaborately planned out, carefully thought out. And South Korea is now probably hooked on this notion that South Korea can talk to North Korea, look at them straight in the eye, and get things done. Although in reality, North Korea again got South Korea to turn the loudspeakers off. South Korea has gotten nothing.
What do you make, then, of your colleagues and some diplomats and policy officials in the West and even in the United States suggesting that this is some historic watershed and that there's actually, you know, a movement towards real peace here? Have the North Koreans deceived even the West once again in this situation?
Well, we've seen this game play out over the past six decades. So rather than betting that things will be different this time around, why not vastly increase propaganda in the form of radio broadcast, leaflets, other forms of information infiltration into North Korea? North Korea, the regime, tries to keep the people in the dark about the outside world. That's because they have real things to be worried about. South Korea, that other Korean state just across the border, is so much more pleasant, more prosperous, and the Korean state to which many North Koreans have already, at great risk, escaped to.
Sun-Yung Lee is professor in Korean studies and an assistant professor at Tufts University's Fletcher School. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, featuring personalized learning plans that help each member of the household achieve their learning goals. From sewing to Swedish to social media mastery, Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at curious.com/PRI.
Now let's meet Kakpema Yalpala. He's a Colorado entrepreneur with parents from Ghana who is fed up with charity, he says. He's a Yale graduate in public health and is breaking down old models with his company Access Mobile, reaching thousands of Africans in need of health care but who already have smartphones. It's a leapfrogging from text message to clinic with revolutionary results in Africa. But KP, as he likes to be called, told me that the models that are working for people in Uganda and Kenya also have applications for folks in Utah and Kentucky.
The problems that Africans have around healthcare, if we solve them, can actually lead us to innovations that can solve everyone's problems in healthcare. And I think it's that leap of logic, not looking at Africa as a charity case, but saying this is actually a place where we can innovate, not just for the continent, but for the world, which reorients your whole thinking around the problem.
Well, give me the story of a person who benefited from a product or a service that you were providing, or suggested a product or a service that you then began to provide,
right?
Because you were paying attention to things that the rest of the sort of charity model wasn't.
Great. So let me tell you a little bit about the story of Access Mobile. So this is a company that I founded in late 2011. And what we observed when we looked at Uganda as one of our early markets in East Africa was that particularly private hospitals were starting to have an orientation towards realizing that running their hospitals with paper ledgers and files and cash was limiting. Most hospitals say they need an electronic billing system of some kind. Most hospitals said they would love to have some type of health record management that wasn't paper-based. that they would love to be able to communicate with their patients through mobile phones, ideally through text messaging. So from the hospital provider side, the hospital providers are saying, wait, this is a very simple, affordable tool that I can use to just constantly be in touch with my patient and build that bond and help them feel like we care about them, that we can drive certain standard of care. At the same time, we found that the doctors that work in the hospitals that use our product tell us that the patients come into the doctors and said, hey, by the way, doc, I got your message. And so the patients also are in some way even excited. And this may seem like such a simple technology, right? But I know, like, for example, in Kampala, we're one of the first people to do this in the private health sector. So if you're getting a message from one of the leading private hospitals in Kampala, it's probably coming through our system. And now what we can see is we've had 150% growth in consumption of our product from January to now. And so we're on a very aggressive growth curve, which means more and more patients are getting messages. We're shifting the perception of what patients expect from their providers about how they communicate and vice versa.
The technology is simple, but the idea of being connected with a doctor is a revelation. It's about community.
Right. It's about community, and it can be transformational because what we've got here is a scenario where we can leapfrog. And really, this is the fundamental aspect of telemedicine. So telemedicine says if you look at healthcare in Africa, there's an imbalance in supply and demand. So you have many people that want and need access to quality healthcare, and you have a limited number of doctors and of physical infrastructure. So really what we're saying is if everyone in Africa has a mobile phone now, we can basically virtualize the healthcare experience, right? No longer is the infrastructure necessarily physical, right? But it becomes virtual, and the phone becomes the way that we can connect to people. And there's no reason why, if we think big, there's no reason why if you're a doctor in Kenya and someone in rural Zambia has a healthcare need and there's a platform and a phone, that we couldn't even make access to quality healthcare transcend borders. Hmm. And that's where, I mean, that's kind of a big idea. There's a lot of practical issues around regulation. But I mean, I'm making the big leap there. We can start these things within the countries just by linking doctors and patients in really practical ways.
Well, here's a bigger idea. Can the leapfrogging that you see in technology and across institutions and even borders in Africa, can that surmount the obstacles that need to be leapfrogged in Western healthcare, where you do have pre-existing infrastructure that's old and legacy and that everyone's committed to? Can leapfrogging work in the West?
Right. Well, I mean, I believe that as these models evolve in African countries and other emerging markets, that the West is going to take notice because we basically are building things the way they should be built.
And you can do this in Denver and in Africa at the same time?
Oh, goodness. I mean, at this point, my travel schedule, I believe, looks like any international business person. I'm here in the U.S. I've got two young children and a wife who have been very understanding about this journey, as well as my family. So it's a balance, trying to balance my family life and the demands of the growth of this company. I'm probably spending about half my time in the U.S. talking to innovators, raising investment capital, managing my board. Probably spend another half of my time managing my company in Uganda and looking at our expansion. And wherever that may be, we work with partners in the Netherlands. We're expanding in East and West Africa. So it puts me in a lot of places at once.
Well, you and your family will have a great vacation with all those frequent flyer miles.
That is the plan.
Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you.
Kakupema Yelpala, who also goes by KP, is CEO and co-founder of Access Mobile. So when has curiosity ever led you to a great idea? New Orleans. When I moved to New Orleans 12 years ago, I decided to take a Japanese language class at the University of New Orleans. There I met one of my best friends, Colby, who lived right down the street from me. He's the most curious person I've ever known. From New Rochelle, New York, my curiosity most times has taken me off trail in the woods. It's always worth it.
My name is Emily, and I'm calling from St. Louis, Missouri. The first week of my freshman year at the University of Illinois, my curiosity had me follow some Elizabethan dresses to a booth for the What You Will Shakespeare Company. At the time, I had never even read Shakespeare. Now not only have I been involved in over 20 Shakespeare productions, but I consider all those lovely people to be my family.
Call us with your curiosity at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Share your adventures or comment at thetakeaway.org. We want to send a really heartfelt thanks to Colorado Public Radio for hosting us all this week. I'm out tomorrow. Todd Zwillick will be with you from New York. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.